Pausing and stopping until you speak. Now you can continue with your experience at Cambridge.
Well, before we go there, I think I should go back to Brooklyn and say that the liveliness of that scene, which came mostly from Mark and Fantasy, was pretty remarkable. And getting to know people like Debye and Flory and Bill Baker and so forth, that accelerated my career and my whole sense of professionalism enormously, and I think it's a very important part of it.
So the, Bill Baker was at...
he came to these Saturday seminars. It was a,
It
was a really a great gathering.
Okay, Bert Nichols mentioned those Saturday seminars. He used to come up for moments and thought they were outstanding. They must have been to be worth a trip for a moment.
In those days, And I'm sure that a lot of others that Debye and Flory and Bill Baker stand out, I think, and the DuPont people. And
of course, New York and Brooklyn are very strategically located for people coming in and out. And I suppose you had
other things.
Did you have a lot of people drop in at Columbia just on their way through? Seems to me going to England in 1946 was wouldn't have been my ideal choice.
No, I was not very sybaritic then, I don't think, and but it was pretty hard. In fact, 46 was their worst winter. The coal ran out. Rivers overflowed, and the electricity was on only on a few hours a day. And I still remember the headlines in the paper in Cambridge when they raised the amount of meat and sausages from 5% to 10%. So it was, it was better to go through that one used later on.
Was it, I suppose there was nothing comparable to that, even with World War shortages in Brooklyn?
No.
You were comfortable, no problem?
Yeah, you had the ration cards, but it was not, not much meat, but it was pretty good compared to England.
Well, what did you work on?
Well, in England, I was, Cambridge, too, was just coming back together after the war, and Mark's friend there was Eric Riedel, R-I-D-E-A-L, and he came back as professor of colloid science, and that wasn't quite my cup of tea, but I didn't have any other contacts, nor was there much going on either. And he had a younger collaborator, Schulman, and so I worked some with him on surface balances and monolayers and so on. But it wasn't very interesting work. And but there were other people that I got to know, like Gordon Sutherland with the infrared.
Oh, yes.
And at that time, Woodward here was making the synthetic polypeptides, and I carried them back and forth, and that was quite intriguing, although we didn't have any publications.
You mean you made trips back and forth?
Yes, I think somehow I brought them together, yes. I think I took the samples when I went, and Sutherland got the first spectra of polypeptide bonds in beta form and random form. And in fact, I named my son after him. And then Kenneth Bailey was there, a protein chemist. He later died, but he was a long talk with him. And then I guess most of all with Max Fruits. And he was already established working on hemoglobin, and I think he was probably the most influential person, as he has been ever since.
Now, was this where your interest in biopolymers,
so that really seems to fell together, that having this some poly work in synthetic polymers, that I should try to see if to what extent the same principles applied to the more complex molecules.
Did it seem to you right away that the light scattering would be applicable?
Well, I guess I just thought I would give it a try. As I was throwing it back and forth between the X-ray work, which seemed promising, but which I didn't have much background in, and solution work, which I did have a background in. So there came out of that the attempt to use synthetic analogs of proteins and nucleic acids and to go at them in the way one had studied high polymers.
Well, you did a paper on light scattering studies of tobacco mosaic virus with Austria.
Oh, with Austria, yes, I forgot about that.
Was that after you got back, or was that earlier?
I think that was earlier, if I'm not mistaken.
The paper was dated 47, but...
Yeah, I think that was... It might have been work... I just can't remember. But Austria was in New York, and I not at Notre Dame, and... So I think that was sort of work that he carried on, and we wrote it up when I got back. I think that's probably the way it was.
Continue talking. I know I've got a copy of that paper here, but
well, I think that was a nice test of things, because that virus is long enough to have a first order diffraction effects with visible light, so we could get its dimensions quite nicely. Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah, that's it, yes.
Oster was at Rockefeller Institute?
I think he was then, yes.
Mm-hmm. And,
yes.
Okay, so that would be
a good.
I wonder if that was the first paper on light scattering from biofilm.
Yes, it might well be, yes. Yes. And then I think, again, just going over this scene in Cambridge, there was also Bill Asbury, who was at Leeds, but he came to Cambridge often. He was before the war, had the best X-ray fiber diagrams of both proteins and nucleic acids. And although they're very poor by present standards, you could begin to see that. There's a very interesting order there. And he was a very lively fellow and wrote a lot of letters back and forth when he didn't come to visit.
Did your wife go over with you?
Yes, and she did some of the work with Schulman.
Well, she was a chemist?
But she was not, she had not been trained as a chemist, so she was a laboratory technician. Mm-hmm. So learned as she went. And then because there were so few American scientists around, I got invited to a number of places. I went to a week or so in Sweden, Gothenburg, and Cedron in Strasbourg.
Right. Now, continue about the... your European contacts?
So I'd say the I remember best the trip to Sweden and the trip to France and Holland.
Of course, now Swedberg had been doing ultracentrifuge work on some biopolymers.
That's right. Yes, so that was a very interesting contact, and he was old but still very lively. Cedron was a physicist who had. Turned to macromolecules and had a difficult wartime experience, but he was setting up shop in Strasbourg, and I visited there several times. And Ben Wall, one of his earliest collaborators, then came over and spent a couple of years here.
At Harvard?
At Harvard, after I got settled. Mm-hmm. And that was a good collaboration. And but I got to know Bernal and Joliot Curie and some of the polymer people in Holland, J.J. Hermans and
Synthetic polymers, yes, as well, yes, as, yes, as well as, yes, the biological.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So that was very good. And so then I came back the following summer. I think I stopped here to give a talk. And by that time, oh yes, also in England, I went down, spent a couple of months in London at the Royal Institution, where Radil had moved, and built a light-scattering apparatus there. And I guess I started to work on the dissociation of insulin as by light-scattering, and I had enough to talk about when I came through here. I remember in September of 48. So I knew sooner I got settled at Notre Dame than I got the offer here, practically, which was difficult because I didn't like to leave Notre Dame so quickly, and I didn't feel these kind of opportunities came along very often, so I
I see.
So I tread water for a year and came here.
Did you, were you able to do much at Notre Dame?
No, I really couldn't. There was no point in building anything.
Oh, I see.
So
I was just about to ask, were the light scattering apparatus at that time was all home built?
Yes, it still was, yes. Yes.
There were no commercial.
No, I think about 1950 they became commercial, yes.
Yeah.
So, and,
did you design yours, or did...
yes, it was all sort of self-designed, yes. And then I think the Phoenix Instrument Company built the first commercial ones, yes.
Was Father Francis Newland still alive, or there at Notre Dame?
I think not. Mm-hmm. No, I can't remember him.
Yeah.
But it was a good place, and it has shown to be since. There was this laboratory for germ-free life, which was going on there. I didn't understand much about it, but it was a very impressive assembly of techniques and so forth, and so there was a little biology there, too.
Did you teach there, or just...
Yes, I taught. Oh, yes, I taught physical chemistry and polymer chemistry, mm-hmm. mostly physical chemistry, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you finally got to Harvard, what did you embark on?
So I got here in 48, and I had three graduate students straight off, and... So we were able, by that time, you were able to prepare nucleic acid fairly well, and starting from thymus glands, which we got out of a local slaughterhouse in those days. And so we started out making pure molecular weight, as pure samples as we could of nucleic acid. It was in the native double-stranded form, although we didn't quite know that then. But also... all of the samples then were degraded and therefore had a molecular weight distribution, not unlike polymers themselves. And so we didn't yet have the samples of identical molecular length from phages and so forth, viruses. So the girl Barbara Bunce did molecular weight measurements on that. That was a good... just to establish the molecular weight range of these somewhat degraded samples was a step forward. And then there was a very bright fellow, Stuart Rice, who's now head of he's the professor at the University of Chicago and head of the one of the material sciences.
Biochemistry?
No, he stayed in chemistry.
Not Rice wrote a textbook, didn't he?
Yes, that's right.
Stuart Rice.
Yeah,
he was
right.
Down at Texas and now at...
he's at Chicago.
I think he was at Texas at the time.
Yeah, maybe.
He co-authored the book.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, I know who you mean now.
Yes, he's a good fellow. Mm-hmm. Well, he was very inventive and got interested in the... denaturation of nucleic acid DNA, and did a lot of the very first work in his thesis on that. The fact is that
because the molecules are stiff and very long, it's quite viscous, but when you go above a critical temperature, they melt out and it becomes very non-viscous, and that's by viscosity and other high polymer techniques, it was very easy to follow.
I see, just during this period, even spanning up to 50, you were still doing papers in on synthetic polymers, though.
Yes, but I this was old work that I was bringing up to date if I didn't have anyone here.
Mm-hmm.
The third fellow worked on proteins, but that didn't lead to very much. So that's how we got started, and then I think for about 10 years, they were probably the most exciting 10 years. It was a matter of going after polypeptides as models of proteins, the synthetic polypeptides, and seeing if we could get those into helical form and solution with the Pauling alpha helix, and we succeeded in doing that. And once you have a ordered single helix, it again is very viscous, but then you go to a temperature beyond which it can sustain itself, it melts out very quickly and becomes much less viscous. And so we could do all of that with polypeptides.
Doing the transitions back and forth.
Yeah,
they were reversible.
Reversible, yes.
Yes.
Very much like one-dimensional melting. And then with DNA, we could do the same thing, and there with the two strands. And we worked very hard to try to show that the molecular weight fell in half when the molecule melted, because that would be consistent with the Watson-Crick theory of the two-stranded helix. And that was difficult to establish because the extrapolations of the Zim plot were a little imprecise, but I think we did establish that by 54 or so. And the woman who became my wife, Helga Botka, she was a graduate student then and did ice-cutting study on gels, using gelatin and degraded collagen. So that was our attempt to explore gelatin and collagen, and it was an interesting paper, but we wanted to get on to collagen itself because feeling that it was a three-stranded helix. And so by 56, when I gave this talk at the National Academy Sciences, we had the parallelism between the helix coil transition for a single-stranded helix and the polypeptide, a double-stranded helix in DNA, and a triple-stranded helix in collagen. So that was in a sort of a nice unifying point of view and showed that phase-like transitions could occur in single, double, and triple-stranded biological molecules. So that was sort of the first phase of the work at Harvard, although other things were going on.
Let me back up to, the Harvard chemistry faculty being farsighted and hiring you? And were they thinking in terms of biochemistry?
I think they probably were. I think that they seemed quite interested in this little lecture I gave on insulin dissociation. And really, there was no biochemistry in those days except of what E.J. Coleman doing over at the medical school on protein fractionation, essentially.
Here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
there was no one who knew about tobacco mosaic virus or any kind of viruses. It was really
I'm trying to think that we're talking about late 40s. Okay, I had a faculty advisor at Iowa State. Nixon was his name. He became the dean of the School of Science.
Yes, I certainly remember his name.
There was a guy named Fox there also.
That's right, yes.
You knew him?
Yes.
I'm sure Nixon was more of a classical biochemist.
Yes, I think so.
He tried to persuade me to go into biochemistry.
I see.
I didn't want to do your analysis.
Yes. The man who's now at the University of California in Santa Barbara.
Biochemist?
Yes, from Iowa. He started out in Iowa and did life scaling and tobacco egg virus, I remember. Zinsheimer.
Okay.
He was at Ohio State, I guess. But he was the physicist.
It wasn't Iowa State at Ames. I think what you're saying, if I understand, is that at this point, the really fundamental physical studies of biopolymers in solution were just taking off.
Yes, and it really, I think, sort of got established by these configurational studies, because they never thought about high polymers having this this endowment to take on these helical forms. But then along came stereospecific polymerization work of Natta and others, and there you were. Although they, of course, didn't exist in solution, it was only in the crystalline form. And of course, that was sort of lucky for me too, because I got involved and I was consulting for Union Carbide. And going back to Charleston, West Virginia, where I'd been born. And so these came along at that time, and was in a unique position to know a little bit about helical macromolecules.
Let's see, you got involved as an expert witness in the polypropylene.
So that was.
Did you actually work with polypropylene?
I only talked about it and read the papers and so forth, yes. And also, I'd also gotten into infrared work with Alkan Blaut on the polypeptides, and indeed he made many that we studied. I had a fairly good understanding of the infrared side, and the X-ray side was fairly easy on that material. So I'll get into that, and I was on that 19 years. I guess it was the longest interference ever came down the pike.
It's going to continue.
And it isn't over,
huh? Being appealed. There's so much money there, it'll be fought on forever.
Yes, I suppose so, yes.
No. It's a curious story. Interesting story, because the people involved in the politics.
I only knew a small fraction of it.
Did you ever get any patents or get
involved in anything
of your own?
Can I?
Got turned on. You just mentioned consulting, could we digress a little bit about who you've consulted for and what some of your experiences have been?
I did Union Carbide probably 6 or 7 years, and then this insurance case where I went to Chicago a fair amount for Standard Oil. And
were you a regular consultant with Standard? Or just on the
interference.
I see.
Yes.
Let's move that cord aside. There.
And to Gillette a few times. Didn't develop anything very permanent.
So this consulting was basically in polymers, polymer solution properties, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And then by 1955 and 56, they discovered the enzyme which can make synthetic polyribonucleic acids, or CHOA.
got the Nobel Prize for that. And one of the people that worked with him, Fresco, came up here as a postdoc. And we entered into the project of making synthetic polynucleotides. You're monitoring the tape when you...
I can hear it with this. Uh-huh. Try to keep track of what's coming across.
Uh-huh. Good. Well, then, having gone through the phase of
polypeptides, which I've mentioned, and we did a lot of optical rotation studies there that were very good. In fact, two papers from that period, one with Ernie's and one with Holsworth, have been recorded by the Scientific Information Institute in Philadelphia as among the 250 most quoted papers, I think.
Holsworth?
Yes.
Holsworth.
Yes. And the one by Urey's, which was a review and reviews of protein chemistry.
Yeah, I was looking at one of your articles. It was on the asymmetry and the optical rotary dispersion work. Is that part of what you're talking
about?
Yes,
it's part of the same thing.
Optical rotary dispersion.
That's right. So we put a good slug on that, and that was good.
Did you introduce the use of the optical rotary dispersion measurement?
I think in terms of its application to proteins, yes.
Was that with commercial equipment, or did you build your own?
It was commercial, but it was pretty modest. And the students in this 65th anniversary recalled how they went blind trying to use it.
Required direct
direct observation and matching hemispheres.
Wasn't there a recording optical rotary dispersion?
I think it came along not very much later, yes. So, yes, it's much better.
A few people had to do it the hard
way. That's right. And we did the polarized optical rotation, and were able to get the, for example, the optical rotary dispersion and the infrared spectra of the three configurations of the polypeptide chain: the random coil, the beta form, and the alpha helix. And so from that one could get a rough estimate of the extent of these three configurations in proteins, and that is quite helpful, particularly in selecting proteins for X-ray determination and so on. And Elkin Blout, who's now professor of the medical school, was a good collaborator in this period. But then we went on to the polynucleotides in the middle and late 50s, and that went quite well, too. We could get DNA-like double-stranded helices out of them, and even triple-stranded helices. So that was a useful period, too. And during this time, my wife had shifted to study ribonucleic acids, and demonstrating for the first time the kind of localized structure that can develop by base pairing in single-stranded ribonucleic acids, and how one could use various denaturing agents and remove that localized structure and put all the physical chemistry of the ribonucleic acids in a very satisfactory form, and she was largely responsible for that.
Did Helga continue working when the children came along?
Yes, I think one time she took off 6 months, and the other time just a couple of those. So she was a good worker. We were benefited by having a house just 100 yards away, and I think that saved the situation in many ways.
Has the house gone now?
Oh, no, no. It's an old Cambridge fortress. It'll be there.
Oh, really?
Forever, I think. So,
pause.